Margaret Thatcher era Britain, the downsizing of government. So this is something that patients talk about a lot, and actually providers talk about a lot too, that we're all under so much stress. So the rest of this talk, I'm going to be talking about mindfulness, which is one particular perspective in working with stress. So I'm going to talk from that particular perspective. Before I do that, just to realize that there's a body of literature on the impact of stress on health. So this isn't, it's not just the fact that it's stressful or unpleasant. There are probably physical health consequences to being under a lot of stress. So this is shown in like PTSD, an area that I work in now. There's excess comorbidity with cardiac disease, asthma, musculoskeletal disorders. It's thought to be because of that revving up of the stress response continually leads to health consequences. And this is just to make you aware that there's a whole body of literature on early life stress. So this is in rodent models. So if you have prenatal stress to rodents, noise and restraint in the last week of gestation, this is pretty far along in gestation, we have neophobia, fear of new experiences, avoidance behaviors basically, increased hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis reactivity. So on the other side, in maternal care, licking and grooming of pups, so basically attachment behaviors, like a strong attachment to the mother, leads to neophilia, you know, this increased interest in novel experiences, so forth. So maternal separation in animal models leads to, you know, these avoidance behaviors as well. And there's evidence both ways. Novelty exposure, so exposure to novel situations in rodents, you know, like, wow, this is an interesting maze I'm running through or something, you know. It leads to enhanced spatial working memory, social competition, you know, it's healthy. So we're influenced by life stressors in ways that are tangible. There are also very interesting social studies about the influence of various emotional states on health outcomes. So we hear about the type A personality, you know, the driving personality. Multiple studies have teased that out and looked at what it is within that pattern, and it's the hostility and anger that's associated with excess heart disease in particular. Depression and PTSD are also associated with excess heart disease. There's a nun study, which is very interesting. So there are a group of young women who were about to enter a convent, and they were asked to write a one-page essay about their view on life and their life story. Researchers, decades later, went back and scored that for the emotional content, sort of their own narrative. And they found that there's a decreased overall mortality 2.5 times between the upper and lower quartiles in terms of the amount of positive emotion that they expressed versus their level of negativity. It's kind of interesting because it's not controlled, but they all lived very similar life conditions. They didn't marry. They probably didn't smoke and drink as nuns. So it's very interesting. Pet studies, you know, we talk about pet therapy, like the act of having a pet. It's very interesting. I heard a woman who runs a program for veterans talk about the rationale for this, and it's very, very eloquent. You know, if your pet often has needs that are in the here and now, you know, they want you now. You can't be off sort of thinking about the future and planning and worrying, you know, because you're brought back to now. And there's this, you know, this recurrent, you know, emotion of like affection you feel or attachment. So just the act of feeling that throughout the day, it's thought to result in health benefits. We're probably familiar with the fact that marriage studies suggest a health benefit to being married, and for men, I think, actually, is what that is. Yeah. The Whitehall studies are in, like, Margaret Thatcher era Britain. They did drastic downsizing of government, and they, you know, like in this study, they showed that the knowledge, the fear that this could happen, and then the knowledge that it was going to happen to like one particular bureau of the government. They followed these people and compared them to other bureaus who didn't have to go through that stress, and found that they had increased BMI and ischemic events and so forth. There are health consequences to this. I'm going to show a few neuroimaging studies because the idea is that these lead to effects on our brain as well. So like when the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis is revved up, there's a negative feedback loop. The cortisol goes back and binds to areas in the brain to shut off that that drive. And it's thought that this cortisol production over time can lead to atrophy of the hippocampus, which is a very important area in our brain for it's what involved in memory and learning and also putting things into context as well. And it's also involved in spatially finding our way. So there's a study done of London taxi drivers where they have to pass this difficult exam called the knowledge, which is the knowledge of London streets, which is very complicated. So there's a study showing that their hippocampal volume goes up as a result of learning this spatially. It's kind of interesting. So in PTSD, for example, 50% of people with PTSD have smaller hippocampus volumes, thought to be probably because the cortisol drive from being under stress, hypervigilance, re-experiencing, that binds the hippocampus and causes it to shrink, which is unfortunate because that's the area that you need to really put things into context, both intellectually and in spatial terms. So mindfulness. So what is mindfulness? We hear this term, it's used a lot nowadays. I wasn't mindful, I forgot my keys. That's not quite the meaning that I'm talking about here in terms of mindfulness and its role in health and stress reduction. So fundamentally, mindfulness involves attention. So the perspective is that we don't have freedom necessarily in what comes into our lives, the experiences, but we have a certain ability to bring attention to those experiences in a healthy way, in a way that doesn't add to the difficulty that we experience. So mindfulness involves bringing attention. This was recognized early on by William James, a famous psychologist and philosopher, who wrote, "The faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. No one is compass sui, master of oneself, if he had it not. An education which should improve this faculty would be education par excellence, but it is easier to define this ideal than to give practical instruction for bringing it about." So, it's very prescient, this insight there. This preceded the recognition of mindfulness programs and mindfulness trainings. This is what mindfulness does. It brings back a wandering attention. That the exercises that are done in mindfulness classes bring back a wandering attention over and over again. And I'll talk about why is that important? That seems okay. But there are a lot of reasons why that's very important. So this is the academic definition that's usually given in articles on mindfulness, and this is from Jon Kabat-Zinn, who started mindfulness-based stress reduction in 1979. This 8-week-long program that we teach at the VA, and it's occasionally offered here as well. But he says, it's very carefully worded. So it's the awareness that emerges by paying attention on purpose in the present moment and without judgment. So there's a lot sort of packed in there. So there's a certain awareness that the act of bringing attention to cycles of thoughts over and over again, like seeing, like, there I am, planning into the future, going into my to-do list again, and then coming back, it somehow loses its... We tend to reify those thoughts in a way. We tend to identify with them. We tend to consider them to be real in a certain way. That the act of bringing attention to it, it's held more loosely as a thought or a pattern of thoughts. Right? So historical terms, mindfulness is most well described in the Buddhist tradition. So when we talk about it in psychological programs and studies, and most of the research I'm going to talk about, it's not coming from that perspective. It's from the modern perspective of understanding how the mind works. But you can see why that would arise from the Buddhist tradition, because that sort of sense of self, like who you are, like this is who I am, is seen to be a construct by paying attention to it in a certain way. So bringing attention to this idea that you have of who you are and how things are and how other people are. to seeing that that's an idea, right? So in the, from the Buddhist perspective, like that's the fundamental need of a that's the pathway to reduced stress. Actually, it's just to see through that false sense of self and who you are and how things are, that, to see those as an idea, without necessarily doing, you know, therapy or correcting those thoughts or substituting other, but just seeing it as a thought, like as a as an idea. So seeing through that constructed sense of self and other in the spiritual traditions is really, this is a path, this is a path for that. So that's where this comes from. So it leads to this decentered sense of self that, you know, that there's no judgment there, that things should or shouldn't be in a certain way, that there are thoughts that arise and pass away. There are ideas of ourself and others. So to hold that without judgment and see it more clearly is really what mindfulness is pointing toward. Okay? And there's a certain quality of attention. So it's been described as intention, attention, and attitude. This is a group of academic researchers has published a paper with a conceptual model describing mindfulness as intention, attention, and attitude. So it's having a certain intention, meaning it's sort of a direction that you would like to go. So bringing that into mind, into awareness, is useful. Like, you know, what is it that is truly valuable to me? What value is this in service of? It's a phrase that's used. So that would be intention. Bringing attention, so not being off, kind of like churning something over that's happened in the past and blocking out and losing touch with what's here, you know, would be a quality. The placement of attention is in the here and now, because that's where you're actually living, is the perspective. And then attitude is one of non-judging, kindness, openness, curiosity is a nice word. It's difficult to be judging if you're curious, you know, sort of it. Yeah, you know, even if you're feeling something that, you know, the present moment may involve, you know, sadness or pain or anger. So bringing curiosity to that, you know, to be open to that, to hold that without judgment, that it should, you should or shouldn't be that way, right? So it's an acceptance-based perspective, okay? So this is another simpler... So this is actually from Spirit Rock Meditation Center, which is outside of San Francisco, and is a sort of, you know, a mindfulness meditation center where a person could go on a retreat, either a day-long retreat or a multi-day retreat. As you're driving in, this is what greets you. So and that kind of says it all. Yield to the present, you know, with whatever is here. You know, whether it's what you would choose, you know, if you could choose, you know, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, to be more open to that. So in terms of psychological mechanisms, so I'm going to talk more in the language of modern psychology, there's a de-identification that occurs through mindfulness practice. So this this constructed sense of who we are, our identity, is loosened up by bringing attention to that and holding with certain curiosity and openness. Often people begin to realize that there's a storyline of like how, you know, they're job should be and how people should be, and you know, there's a story, a narrative that arises, and the focus is on that, but it sort of shifts it from that back to, you know, the feelings really, which are often more that you're in some type of pain really, like when they're especially like a narrative that, you know, a lot of judgment, things should be different. It really, like, to let go of that and come back to the felt sense of how you're doing, you know, and come back to the breath and the body is what's taught in mindfulness practice, to stay with that, because that's actually where, you know, you're closer to truth there about like what action would be skillful, what would be helpful. There's a book written by three authors. One of them is Mark Williams. So there's Williams, Teasdale, and Siegel, and Jon Kabat-Zinn is the fourth author, called The Mindful Way Through Depression. It's a really good book with a practice CD if you wanted to buy a book. Actually, the audio book is great, just listening to it in your car. Just a beautiful description of mindfulness practice and why it's important. So Mark Williams is an Oxford psychiatrist, and those other two people I mentioned are also psychiatrists that are depression researchers. So they got really interested in mindfulness practice and went and studied mindfulness-based stress reduction for about 3 years and to try to figure out, like, what it is that, why is this helping people? And what they defined was the element of rumination. So this is something that we all do to varying degrees, I think. So if, when we talk about attention, something that we perceive as being a problem holds our attention. Like, it's pretty easy to keep your attention on something that's wrong, you know, this needs to be solved, I need to... If something is perceived as a problem. And often the natural response to that is to ruminate on it, to dwell on it, to keep your attention there, to, like, think about it some more. And that can bring up very dark moods or low moods. And it's very difficult to get out of those moods, especially if you have a history of depression. So for a person with a history of depression, it's very difficult to get out of that cycle once, because it calls up a lot of memories, moods, what's called a mode of mind or mental sets that lead to depression. So what these researchers figured out is that mindfulness practice attenuates that cycle of rumination. And that's very helpful. So it's you know, that ability to see, oh, ruminating mind, welcome, old friend, you know, to sort of greet that with a certain openness, like, oh, I see you, or just, I see you, there it is. Okay. You know, and to, like, let that go and come back, instead of, like, adding additional energy to that with the knowledge that that's what leads to relapse of depression for people with a history of depression. And, you know, not to ignore those issues, but the ability to set that aside is considered very important, very healthy. That's a very useful skill to learn. And that's an important point, too, that the research shows that this is a skill that can be learned, that it's, you know, we're not static in that way. We're not fixed in our abilities. So people can learn these abilities to let go of cycles of thought that lead to low mood and anger and so forth. And interestingly, psychological studies show that our problem-solving ability, it actually goes down the more we stay focused on a single problem. Like, our scope of attention is quite narrow. We have the same repetitive thoughts over and over. So the act of letting that go actually leads to a broadening of perspective and, you know, other possible solutions or ideas about what can be done. Another element of thought, or a function of our mind that's highly prevalent that people become more aware of, is the inner critic, or the voice of judgment, or the superego, depending on which term you want to use. So there's this, often outside of our awareness, you know, there's this sort of inner critic that's we're criticizing ourselves for not being a certain way, to not living up to some internalized ideal of how we should be or how our life should be. Right? So in mindfulness practice, when a person is able to bring attention to those cycles of thought, it often loosens that up. Just the act of seeing that, they're like, oh, you know, there's this voice within me that's criticizing me. But that's a really big element. I think in healthcare in particular, we hold ourselves to very, very high standards, as we should. But there's a difference between doing it from the perspective of wanting to be excellent, wanting to provide a service, wanting to you know, approach truth in what we're doing, in a diagnosis or treatment, and criticizing yourself if it doesn't work out exactly that way. So this is an area that I think can really open up a lot of space for people, like in their lives, to be less held to certain unrealistic standards. The other aspect that plays a big role in our lives is avoidance. A very natural response is when we feel some sort of pain or discomfort is to want to make that go away, which is certainly reasonable. And if that's possible, then we probably should do that. But often that's really not possible. Or if we're feeling pain or sadness or hurt, anger, those are often quite unpleasant states to stay with. And the natural tendency maybe want to avoid that by distracting yourself, you know, by keeping really busy all the time, or watching TV, or, you know, logging onto the computer, just kind of like thinking about what's there, or eating is a common pattern. There's stress-related eating is well defined. It's called emotional eating, where we sort of use food as a coping mechanism. There's some evidence that eating activates the hedonic areas of the brain, similar to addictions. So it feels good when we eat. Drinking, drugs, you know, the whole spectrum of avoidance behaviors. So the reason, you know, that's not so helpful is, you know, rather obvious, is that, you know, those behaviors in and of themselves can lead to consequences. But also, just the ability to understand what's behind those feelings is lost if they're blocked out in a certain way. So mindfulness practice fundamentally teaches people a way of staying with their experience, to stay with it, to see it, even if it's not what you would choose, to be curious about it, to be open, to feel it more deeply, actually to move closer to experience. And to really, from the perspective of, try that out and see if that's more helpful or less helpful than blocking it out, you know, from avoiding it over the trajectory of your life. To have people try that out. And the attempt is to teach people ways of learning from their own experience, that we can learn to learn from our experience, right? And so mindfulness practice, this way of being open, a way of processing our own experience without avoiding it or blocking it out, right? So probably the most extreme example of avoidance would be trauma. So post-traumatic stress disorder, one of the hallmarks is avoidance behaviors. The experience of the past from a traumatic episode clouding the present moment experience, having a big influence on the present moment. You know, the avoidance of being around other people, the avoidance of internal states of shame, or guilt, or anger. So if those are to be freed up, they need to be brought into the open of awareness and to be processed, is the theory. So there are a lot of mindfulness programs in healthcare. It's, if you did a PubMed search for mindfulness, you would come up with hundreds, probably thousands of articles. There have been numerous randomized controlled trials and mindfulness programs. There are two meta-analyses published of mindfulness programs. In managed care programs like the Kaiser system, mindfulness is becoming more and more offered. Yeah, you walk into the lobby of a Kaiser and they have a big mindfulness-based stress reduction poster on the wall. In the National Health Service in the UK, for persons with major depressive episodes, three or more episodes, they offer mindfulness training because it's been shown to decrease the relapse rate of depression. So the first mindfulness program to appear in healthcare was mindfulness-based stress reduction in 1979 at the University of Massachusetts. And it has since grown to be available widely throughout the United States. So there are more than 250 programs in the United States. And there's a body of literature, which I'll touch on, to support it. MBCT is a specialized program. It's almost exactly like mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is another... It's an 8-week program, once a week for 8 weeks, with some additional teaching about depression. These next two were actually developed at the University of Washington. Mindfulness-based relapse prevention is a program designed to teach mindfulness in the setting of persons with alcohol or drug abuse disorders. So, as I was talking about avoidance behaviors, sort of that the impulse to want to drink alcohol or use drugs, you know, learning mindfulness can teach other ways to cope with you know, the emotions that precede the need to use drugs. So the theory is that you can replace those avoidance behaviors with with mindfulness. You can attenuate those avoidance behaviors. Dialectical behavioral therapy and acceptance commitment therapy or other mindfulness programs that don't involve meditation, which is a really interesting thing. So one of the ways you could learn mindfulness by working with attention is through doing meditation exercises, which is what mindfulness-based stress reduction is based on. Dialectical behavioral therapy, developed by Marsha Linehan at the University of Washington, professor of psychology for borderline personality disorder. They don't teach formal meditation exercises. It's more like grounding and mindfulness, you know, mindfulness, behavioral aspects of mindfulness, doing other exercises that teach mindfulness. So there are other ways to learn this as well. And increasingly, there are specialized applications. So eating, so there are programs being developed around eating, eating disorders specifically. It's been shown to reduce binge eating in small studies. There are childbirth and parenting programs. So working with a pregnant woman before she gives birth to teach mindfulness skills that will then carry over to the infant and develop strong attachment with the infant, which the hope is that would then carry over throughout the course of the lifespan for this young baby. So the trend is toward developing more specialized programs with increased education and awareness of specific issues within healthcare and life. So MBSR began in 1979. Jon Kabat-Zinn was a PhD-trained molecular biologist from MIT, and so a very scientifically oriented person. He had a knowledge of these practices and just had the insight that this would be very helpful for people with chronic pain and other conditions. So there was a Bill Moyers television special that was produced in the early 90s that, if you want to watch a good 45-minute segment on a mindfulness program, it's a really nice snapshot of that. Bill Moyers, Healing in the Mind. Healing from Within is the segment. So it's 2.5 hours a week for 8 weeks, plus an all-day session on a Saturday. Gradually, the program works through a variety of mindfulness practices, including body scan meditation, breathing meditation, some gentle yoga, walking practices. So I'm curious, how many people have been to a yoga class in Europe? All right, yeah. So one thing about yoga, the instructions are very specific. So there's this bringing back of attention to what you're doing in that moment. Also, there's a sensation produced by doing yoga, so you can feel the stretch, and it's very almost involuntary. That instead of thinking about what you're going to be cooking for dinner that night, you come back to being more aware of your body. You're more in the present moment. So from the perspective of mindfulness, that's what's being taught in yoga classes. Very skillful means of learning mindfulness. So there are a number of studies of mindfulness practice that have looked at the neurological effects of mindfulness practice. And this one came out earlier this year, so I thought I would highlight it. This is a group from Mass General in Boston who, using prior pilot work of neuroimaging studies, they did a randomized controlled trial where people had neuroimaging at baseline with MR scans, and then they were randomized to this 8-week MBSR class or a wait list, basically no MBSR class. And they were imaged after completing the course. So this is after just 8 weeks of going through a mindfulness course. And in these predefined areas within the brain, they showed that there was increased gray matter concentration in these areas that are involved with emotional regulation and the sense of the body as well. They also showed that the hippocampus increased in density as well. So it's actually pretty striking. This really caught the attention of the lay press, and I don't know if you read the New York Times online, but it was the most emailed article, you know, on that list of the New York Times articles. There was a newspaper article about this study and received a lot of press. As it should. It's actually pretty striking. You know, it tells us that there are physical structural changes that occur as a result of practices like this. This is another study of the neurophysiology of mindfulness practice. So this is putting people in a functional MRI scanner and looking at which part of their brain lights up when they're shown emotionally distressing images, faces that have a lot of emotion. And then they correlated those results with the trait level of mindfulness for each individual, and people that had a greater level of mindfulness at baseline had a greater prefrontal cortex activity during these maneuvers. So it kind of brings up another point, which is that you can actually measure mindfulness. There are well-validated measures of mindfulness that have been developed, and they correlate with a number of different measures of mental health. So the ability to be more mindful is correlated with mental health. So each person would score slightly differently if we administered a questionnaire, and that's what they did in this study, is to correlate that with certain brain area activity. There was also an interesting study that occurred where at the time that they were doing this randomized control trial, randomizing people to an MBSR series versus a wait list control arm, it was the season to give the flu shot. So they looked at the difference in rise of influenza titer for people who went through a mindfulness class versus controls, and the titer rise was significantly higher in the mindfulness group compared to the control arm. And that makes sense. You know, we're talking about the physiological effects of stress, you know, revving up the cortisol production and the influence on the autonomic nervous system as well. But they're putative mechanisms that make sense. So from a psychological perspective, the most fundamental difference between cognitive therapy and mindfulness practice would be that mindfulness primarily emphasizes the context of thought rather than the content of thought. So the point in mindfulness practice is to see the functionality of the mind more clearly, to see how cycles of thoughts can go off, and to just hold that without judgment, to see that for what it is, as an automatic reaction pattern. So in a mindfulness class, if a person were to raise their hand and say, you know, I feel really angry because, you know, this room is set up all wrong, and, you know, as I sit here, I wonder if I should just be doing something completely different, and, you know, and I don't like anybody I'm sitting next to, and, you know. So the response would be more like, how great it is that you're able to see that you're having all these thoughts as you sit down here. You know, this is what a wonderful opportunity to work with this, you know, like to see that more clearly, rather than, you know, why do you feel that way? Like, what makes you think that? You know, there's not the emphasis on teasing out, like, reality testing. Like, well, I mean, this is a reasonable design for this room. And, you know, did something else happen this morning that made you feel? You know, there isn't that sort of, in MBSR classes, there's not that type of interchange. It's more like to hold in awareness, like, whatever it is that comes up, and to be able to see that a little more clearly. Okay. And through that process, I think that, you know, what's called cognitive change does occur. Then we begin to question, like, huh, I wonder if that's really true, you know, like what I just said. You know, there's that holding up a certain curiosity. I really do believe that unfolds on its own, that a person is able to learn a certain process for seeing those thoughts and feelings a little more clearly, and then to work with sort of what's behind that. Okay, so briefly, I'd like to just review a little bit of work with PTSD. We've been teaching MBSR at the VA hospital. We're in our fifth year of doing that. And we've had between 500 and 600 veterans go through these classes. Most commonly, people have PTSD, depression, and chronic pain, often in combination. In an MBSR group, there will be 20 to 30 veterans per group. There's one teacher. There are a number of studies to support the use of mindfulness interventions. Specifically, MBSR is the most studied mindfulness intervention, but there are other interventions as well. Major depression, anxiety disorders. There are a whole host of studies showing that a person's stress level and anxiety goes down after going through a mindfulness course. chronic pain is a really good indication. There's a physical component to pain, and then there's an emotional, affective component to pain as well. And that's what can be worked with, that a person's level of catastrophizing or certain beliefs about their body or what the future holds for them, those can be worked with to see those more clearly. There's some evidence for fibromyalgia, binge eating disorders. There are two randomized control trials that psoriatic plaques clear more quickly if a person is less stressed. There are a number of studies of cancer quality of life, a number of studies of workplace stress. And there's a recent study that employed mindfulness in JAMA for physician burnout, so I thought I would talk about that. This shows the cycle of low mood that is thought to occur with rumination, so that if we can see that pattern before going down that path, that it's easier for us to get out of that, you know, to let go of that mood. This is from a randomized controlled trial, so where persons with major depressive episodes were randomized to either a mindfulness intervention, 8 weeks long, or treatment as usual. And all of these people had received psychotherapy, antidepressants. Some of them had been hospitalized for depression. They received all the accepted treatments for depression. So the vertical axis is the proportion of patients not relapsing. So you can see that in the MBCT arm, that the proportion was much higher. So the proportion not relapsing was much higher. The relapse rate was cut in half. And there are actually two studies to show this. So when we talk about PTSD, this is what it looks like in real life. That just your typical Seattle yoga studio here, working with the veterans. Which, you know, sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words, because historically this came from spiritual traditions, or the roots of that. But when people have a lot of problems that aren't going to go away, learning mindfulness, it doesn't matter to them where this came from at all. I've been really impressed by the acceptability of doing something like this, even at the VA hospital. If you want to watch something really moving on the Seattle channel on the 28th of this month at 7 p.m., there's a half an hour documentary film made by a filmmaker I work with, who I got to know, who followed a series of veterans before these classes, through them, and after them. And, you know, there are people who were Navy SEALs. There are people who were in Mogadishu, like Black Hawk Down type situations. And they talk about this and how they understand mindfulness and how this has helped them. So we followed a group of 92 veterans over 6 months. This is simply pre-post, and looked at the rate of clinically significant change. So these are relatively large changes that they have to meet a certain criteria for their scores to change that are clinically significant, that are relevant. Which would, on this, would be PTSD symptoms. A 10-plus point change in the scale uses a significant, it's a robust change. So 48% of people had an improvement in PTSD symptoms. The mental component summary score, the SF-36, is a summary measure of functionality in terms of how much they're limited or impaired by mental health issues. And 36% had clinically significant change over 6 months. Less so for the physical quality of life. Then we did a small randomized control trial, and we looked at PTSD symptoms and mental health-related quality of life for MBSR versus a usual care group, which is what the gray line is. And the outcomes that were significant in this small pilot study were mental health-related quality of life. In the PTSD symptoms in our small group weren't significantly different, but the mental health-related quality of life measure was significantly different. And actually, interestingly, when we think about this, so we often, we're focused on relieving symptoms in medicine. And I had the idea that, and other people have written about this quite extensively, that a successful treatment should involve more than just relief of symptoms, that there's the aspect of healing, that a person's functionality should improve, their quality of life should improve, their satisfaction should improve as well. So when we apply that definition, that they both have to have PTSD symptoms improve significantly and their quality of life improve, both of those things, the results were highly significant, that 27% of people in MBSR, people with long-standing PTSD, had improvement on both of those parameters versus 0% in the treatment as usual arm, which is very encouraging. It has caused us to write bigger, much larger grants about this topic. So this is from a combat veteran who was an Army sergeant who served 2 tours in Iraq and 2 tours in Afghanistan. And he came back and he had a lot of unresolved anger, and he used to go out and pick fights with people and couldn't hold a job. And he went through these classes, and there was a newspaper article that came out about the program in general, and they interviewed him, and this is what he said. So it says, "After 4 combat tours, 2 in Iraq and 2 in Afghanistan, normal life seemed impossible for one Seattle Army veteran. His heart raced when driving under an overpass. He had trouble breathing when stuck in snarled traffic. Crowded rooms were just as bad. He locked himself away at home and drank instead of facing large groups or loud, sudden noises. He responded to the slightest sense of threat with all-out aggression." So here's what he says. "It's like the thoughts just lost their hope. Before, they were just ripping me. With mindfulness, it opens up the blinders. You realize those thoughts are not the totality of your existence forever." So that's a really nice description where he's describing decentering. So there's this loss of the belief that those thoughts make up his reality. There's sort of a loosening up of that. There was a study published in JAMA I just wanted to highlight. So there was an 8-week mindfulness course, once a week for 2.5 hours a week, followed by a once a month group that would provide follow-up. And providers did mindfulness exercises, sort of like I've described. And they also did some writing, some narrative, some exploration of events that happened in the workplace, what's meaningful to them about healthcare and so forth, with a mindful sort of perspective. And these show the effect sizes. So D is how many standard deviations from the mean. And these were all highly significant. That there were significant improvements in time of medium to large effect size for burnout, empathy, large effect for mindfulness, and sort of medium to large effect for mood disturbances. And that these changes were correlated with change in mindfulness, which is kind of encouraging. So it brings up this issue that in the workplace, that providers can become more attuned to their own sources of stress and how to work with that. You know, I brought up these perfectionistic tendencies, that whether we're coming from a place of trying to provide good service versus sort of judging ourselves for that is sort of a different way of working with it. We often think very far into the future in healthcare. When I show up and there's a busy clinic, it's very natural to sort of think about all these things that are going to happen. And those are all ideas about what's going to happen, actually. There's a mindfulness saying, which is, you can't wash the dishes, you can only wash a dish. And like the dishes are sort of like a concept. A clinic. The clinic schedule is the concept. What you have in front of you is this one person. So really working from that perspective to see that I can have these thoughts about how hard this is going to be, and really just seeing that for what it is and letting go and really listening to this person in front of me is something that's really influenced me a lot in my practice as a doc. And this is one of the quotes on our workbook, which I like from Walkman. It sort of expresses this larger perspective that we can have that can be fostered through mindfulness practice. So, thank you very much.
There doesn't appear to be any other class that wants to maybe ask a question or two. So.
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer questions. Yeah.
I have a question. Tara Brock, I don't know if you know her work. I've been listening to her CD in my car, and she's talking about trauma, and that if you go immediately to things, you re-traumatize the patient, but sometimes you have to bring in resources to support the person before they can bring up the trauma. I just wonder what you thought of that.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and something that we've thought about a lot, like in the midst of starting these courses in the VA, where most people have PTSD. And so we're pretty very careful in the instructions to really encourage people to not go there if they don't feel ready for that, that they could, you know, just sort of gradually take it gently. And I've also been really impressed by the fact that people don't go places in these classes, in our experience, that they're not ready to go. That they'll often have sort of disturbing or troubling thoughts or memories or images, but not full-blown re-experiencing of trauma in our groups, at least. And that's something that we weren't really sure if it was going to work out that way. Like, is it safe or not? And when I first started doing this at the VA, the original teacher's manual for MBSR says you should exclude people with PTSD. And then I set up these groups, and everybody has PTSD, and I wasn't going to ask them to go away. And then they would come back and just talk about how it's going to help them. But and I would also say that at the VA, so most veterans have been in the system for a while. They've had other resources for PTSD. They've had education about PTSD. Many of them are also seeing a mental health provider as an additional resource. So there are all those considerations as well. Yeah. Any other observations, comments, or yeah?
Are there limitations on level of psychosis and then age for which mindfulness does not work?
I don't think age would be a limitation at all. I mean, so we exclude people with known psychotic disorders. And we exclude borderline personality disorder from our groups just because it might be difficult for a group process. But, age sounds okay. Just depends on the person, I think. So.
Yep. There were a few people that got worse. Not many.
Yeah. Sure.
Did you have any of your tests or any of your impressions sort of say who might those people be, if, you know, when they walk in for a course?
Yeah, so that's one thing we wanted to find out is, like, do some people get worse? You know, over time, are we going to exacerbate people's trauma, for example? And there was a small percentage in each arm of the study who had worsening of symptoms. I think it was about 6%. But it was similar between the two arms, and there's fluctuation over time that occurs in PTSD symptoms. And it was much smaller than the percent that improved, which is 48%. There was one patient in each arm of our little small randomized control trial that got hospitalized for PTSD. So it was equal between the two arms. So we don't screen people that carefully. Like, it's really from looking at their chart and making sure they don't have a psychotic disorder and they're not actively suicidal. And it seems to go well. Like, so it's really, that's one thing that we're wondering about. Like, are we going to make people worse? But you have to, as you know, the what we're teaching is quite gentle, really. So you're teaching people to, like, stay with the breath, you know, with an attitude of kindness and openness. And my impression is that, really, like, the way we're wired is that process is gradual enough that it doesn't bring up a lot of content that we can't handle. That's just been our experience, that it doesn't seem to work that way. So. Yeah, thanks for your time. Thanks for inviting me.
I just wanted to say I really wanted to meet you.